said, it begins with the, or continues, the continuation of that speaks that, it speaks of the 10 markers, the 10 plates. So, if you familiarize yourself with the significance of the plates, where they group, and the purpose of the plates, we didn't get to it last week. It really begins in chapter 7, verse 14, and Hashem says to Moshe that after the preliminary sign that he showed him, when Aaron threw down his rod and became like crocodiles, they followed the cartoon, maybe trying to do the same thing. So it says that Pharaoh's heart became strengthened. Now, there it says that once the, sentence 13, once that the Egyptian magicians were able to emulate and to copy the act of Aaron, so then Pharaoh's heart became strengthened on his own, and he didn't listen to them. So Hashem says then, from it lays power, he tells Moshe, go to power in the morning when he's going out to the water. I'm reading sentence 15. And stand to greet Pharaoh at the sea, at the shore line, and take this matir with you. And you should say unto him, standing by the water, send out my people. You didn't listen unto here until now. And what will happen? That I am going to go ahead and bring about a plague of blood. Now we're familiar with the 10 makos. And we're also familiar with the groupings of the makos. We do that in the Haggadah, where it says, with Yehuda, if you recall, in the Haggadah we missed the 10 plagues, and then we say, with Yehuda, I am no saying Bahem Simoni. But Yehuda gave us a certain way how to recall the plagues. He made words out of them. The words were in three groupings, and Datzach, Adash, Bachab. Now, they really don't mean anything, but the words incorporate the various plagues. Datzat is Dam, Tzvardeya, Kinin. Adash is Orov, Deber, Shefin. Bachab is Borod, Arve, Hoshef, Makis, Peres. Now, we'll explain. There were three groupings, and each group went in a regular pattern. The Jews suffered three things in Egypt. They were first gaming. In the earliest stage, they were strangers. Then they were gathered in by certain chicanery. They were able to be fooled into becoming, got brought into becoming slaves. At the same time, they were persecuted. Now, Pharaoh felt in the Egyptians that they had a haughty superiority, a natural superiority over the Jews, and nothing could happen to them. The plagues were going to show that the exact thing that they did to the Jewish people will happen to them. For example, Gerus. What is Gerus? Gerus means they were strangers. The Egyptians prided themselves by their river. That means they had paradise, in a sense, belonged to them. They weren't strangers. They were the most popular and wealthy and strong, arrogant country because it was their country. They lived there. And the entire lifeline of the Egyptians was the blood. Therefore, Gerus, we will show you that really you don't have any place which you think that you have permanency and it belongs to you. Because I will take over the dam. I will take over with my blood. I will take over the water. That's why really when he tells Pharaoh, when he tells Moshe to go, in sentence 15, he says, go in the morning when Pharaoh goes out to the water. This was a certain religious act that he would do every morning. The water was their god. So he says, when he goes out to the water, I want you to stand there by the water and show him here that this is where he feels at home and this is his permanency, his sanctuary. Show him, know that through this water, I, God, will make him into a ger, into a stranger, that he will, stranger has no lifeline, a stranger loses. You know, when you come into a different country and you don't have a home, you don't have a job, you don't have any basis, any foundation, you feel like a greener, like a stranger. So that's what the idea of Dam would be. That was Gerus. Now after Dam, the The second Makkeh relates to a slave, Abdus. Now, what was the second Makkeh? The second idea, what is slave? Because the superiority over a slave is justified. How do you justify superiority over another people? That he should be a slave? Well, the logic of who we know that people consider themselves to be higher human beings. They're of a higher order. It means there are people that are a step lower. Now, the idea is that genetically, for example, I'm from a higher order of beings. Genetically, I'm greater, so therefore the other person is inferior and he's enslaved. Another reason is that even if you're not genetically greater, even if you're not physically greater or mentally greater, you don't believe in supremacy or in such a type of a racist approach, but the idea of your superiority could be due to power, due to money, to wealth. That's how you make someone else to be your slave. So now the frog. The frog is a very timorous and remote of animals. The frog normally slips away from man. He goes out to the marshes, the bulrushes, and this frog goes ahead, and you don't find him bodily entering into a man's domain. But over here, the frog even hops upon the majesty himself. So in a sense, it shows that his arrogance, the majesty's arrogance and his greatness and so on, doesn't mean anything, because a little frog that is so timid and indeed is genetically inferior has no feelings of respect or no inferiority feelings towards the majesty. So you see that your greatness is nothing. So this is a lesson for Abdus. Then you have the idea of Inu, the persecution and the suffering. So the first suffering that you had was Datsak, was Kinim. Kinim means that the person had a painful, he had full, the lice filled everything over him, his whole house. So that was vermin and lice. So this is the great affliction, this is a great pain. So in a sense, this is the tzach. This is the first level of punishments in an orderly fashion. Punishment one, punishment two, and punishment three. But they weren't really all punishments. One and two was really a lesson. One is preceded Gerus, meaning the one of Gerus, which is number one, number four, and number seven in the list is Gerus. That always, he would go and tell Pharaoh, I am going to do this. He would first go ahead and warn him. And then he would go out to greet him, and then he would warn him, and then he would do it. The second one also, as we see, he will go ahead and warn him. By the third one, there really was no warning. Now how do you see this? Let's just take a look at the first three. Chapter 7, like I just pointed out, sentence 15, when he tells him go to Pharaoh in the morning when he goes to the water and greet him there, because we said of the greatness of the water which gave them this feeling of permanency. And then you had the Tzvadeya. Now when it comes to Tzvadeya, first one is, well, we'll get back to the blood and the water, but then it says, when the Tzvadeya is, sentence 26, he says, come to Pharaoh and warn him again. Send out my people, and if you refuse, in 27, Moena, I thought you refused to send them out, I'm going to plague your entire area with Tzvadayim. And that, we said, would show that you're not the total master. Then the third one, there's no warning. The third one is in chapter 8, correct? Sentence 12. It's chapter 8, sentence 12. He doesn't warn him at all. But it says, God said to Moshe, speak unto Aaron, stretch out the rod, and hit the earth, and it will be vermin, the Choleh Mitzrayim. So there is no warning. Why? Because this was really punishment. Inri, what's he going to warn him? The fact is that he didn't respond to the first two warnings. The first warning was Ger, stranger. Did he learn the lesson? No. The second one, the idea of an Eved, with its Vardeya, he didn't learn the lesson either. If he didn't learn the lesson, so then he has to suffer the inui, the affliction that they suffered. Therefore, there was no warning for the king. When you follow the second grouping, it's the same thing. except in the second grouping. Well, let's go through the first one a little bit more in detail. The idea was, here, 18, how did they do with the water? You notice in sentence 18 tells us that after with the blood, in sentence 18, 7, sentence 18, it says the fish that are in the river shall die. And the Egyptians gave up drinking water from the Yor, from the river, from the Nile. So that's what God said will happen. And now in 19, God says, let's bring it about. But how does he tell them to bring it about? He tells them, take your staff, stretch your hand out on the waters of Egypt, on their streams, and their rivers, and their pools, and in all gatherings where there's water, and there will be blood in Egypt. But 18, by bunny, in the vessels and in the stones, in the wooden vessels and the stone vessels. So we think everything became full of blood. Yet, it says in sentence 22, two sentences further, it says, Ve'yasu kein chatume mitzrayim, ve'lot tehem. The Egyptians also did the same thing. Now, the Pharaoh's heart was hardened. How did the Egyptians do the same thing? There was no water left for them to do it with. He said all the water in the vessels was already full. So what did they do? The answer is, the only thing that was affected, if you notice in 19, Aaron took his rod and he shook it over the waters, the various waters of Egypt. He only shook it over the Nile and any water that was derived or a tributary from the Nile, or even if somebody took Nile water into a pot or a pan in his kitchen, it also became full of blood. But other waters, that means that they had bottled waters from some other source that didn't come from the Nile, or other little rivulets that weren't from the Nile, so that wasn't touched. Because if you look at 20, it says very clear that Aaron smote with his staff, he lifted up his staff and he smote the water that was in the Yehor in the river, which in the eyes of Pharaoh. So that means what he did was he hit the Nile and then he like pointed the staff in the various directions, meaning the waters of the Nile. But not the, because the commentators have trouble where to get the water from. If the pots and pans all had water, they became blood. The answer is only the Nile. So you see how phenomenal it was that a miracle was so great that the water of the Nile, so people had two pots of water in their house. One was Nile water and one was not. One would become blood and one wouldn't become blood. Yet, the Chartume Mitzrayim, it says in 22, the Chartume Mitzrayim did the same thing. They, with their understanding of nature, were able to emulate that. And then his response in 23 was, he turned around and went home. I mean, he has the same kind of magicians. And it didn't even, but like short sleep, it says it didn't even bother him. But the people suffered, but it didn't matter. He didn't respond. You notice by the first one, he didn't beg Moshe to pray for him. He didn't even respond. Why? Because it made no impact upon him. Because his people were able to do the same thing. Now, it then came with the Svardayim, with the, in chapter, then it says in 28, in 7:28, it says, he warned them about these frogs. And then the frogs came out. Look how thoroughly they came out. They came out in 28, the swarm, and they came out onto his house, into his bedroom, into his bed, into the houses of his servants, and into the houses of his people, and in their ovens, and in their kneading troughs. So just picture. If you opened up everything, you would see frogs. It came out, it seems, only in these places. Why did it come out in these places? Because actually, they went ahead and, as Hirsch says a little bit further, to all the instances, if we take the places together which are mentioned as being disturbed so disrespectively by the frogs, we find reference to all the instances in which the Egyptian masters embittered the lives of their Jewish slaves. As Avodim, our fathers had no homes, they had no private family rooms, they had no sleep, no proper bread. Now really, they worked day and night. That's why later we'll see the Jews were slaves, it says in the Torah, 430 years. It says, you know, a number of contradictions there, we may get to it later today. So it says, Some say really that they figured out 215, but since they worked day and night, so they persecuted them day and night, so it was 215, so it came to 430. That was one interpretation. So really they had control over their entire life, and therefore it was in their houses, in their bedrooms. They treated them as actually as what we look at as slavery. So now, if you notice in 28, it says it will come in Pharaoh's and in the Beis Avodecha, in the homes of Pharaoh's servants, Ubamecha, and amongst his people. You notice the order. It will come into his house, to the house of his servants meaning his generals, his officers, his diplomats, and Amecha, the common people. Then in 29, when it doesn't speak about their possessions, next sentence it says, upon you, Ubamecha, and your people, Ubachol Avadecha, and all your servants, that not only in your property, but in your person, the Tzvadayim will rise. So Hirsch notes, why does it say in 28, the order being Pharaoh, his personal servants, and the people? And then when it speaks here, it says, Pharaoh, the people, Ubachol Avadecha, and his servants. So it takes Pharaoh's army, retinue, and puts them last. Why does it change the order? Why does it put the common people, when it speaks about the personal play, it puts them before? So he said an interesting point. He says, in outward appearances, the houses of the court officials were, of course, superior to that of the ordinary populace. Of course, they lived in beautiful homes. They were the great officials of Pharaoh. When it says the houses were punished, Pharaoh's houses, and the great, the generals, the diplomats, the ministers. But when it comes, he says, to respect the actual personalities, under a regime such as Pharaoh's, the court officials are the lowest. It says, in Pharaoh's kingdom, there are only two extremes that are free men. The king is a free man, and comparatively also the ordinary citizen, who at least in his inner private condition is unmolested. He's too insignificant to be considered anything and to afflict him. The ordinary citizen doesn't have any great fear over him. The proper, he says, the gaudily uniformed court officials are really the most despicable slaves because they tremble before the slightest change in the royal mood. If there's a fly in the goblet or a hair in the loaf, right? So this great one goes into the dungeon, and he's led to the gallows. So when you picture it, how true it is. You know, sometimes the kind of person that's a day laborer, he has a certain degree of freedom that a high vice president in some firm doesn't have. He's a big firm, and he's a tremendous... You will go to this guy in the office, he wears Brooks Brothers shoes, and he has a beautiful home in Long Island. And this schlepper will say, where's a pair of overalls, and he works in the mine. But he has a certain freedom that this second class doesn't have. So Hirsch says, when it speaks about the personality itself, in sentence 29, he lists the free in the order of freedom. So it's Becha, Ubamecha, and then Ubachol Avadecha, because they're really outbodied. So they're really a little bit of pity on the commensurate with them. They receive the Tzvadayim last. This is the way he interprets the groupings, which is interesting because it shows a great insight. So when you would see these two things happen, one would think it's definitely the hand of God. Yet he still didn't believe it was the hand of God because, for a simple reason, not because it only happened for a period of time, or some, because his people were able to emulate the same thing, they were able to do the same thing. But were they able to do the Tzvadayim? So everybody quotes sentence 3, where it says, sure they were able to do the Tzvadayim. In sentence 3 it says, if you notice chapter 8, sentence 3, it says, Vayasu chen hachar tumim belotehem. They did the same. Vayalos atzvadim al Eretz Mitzrayim, and the Tzvadim came out on Eretz Mitzrayim. So now, in sentence 4 it says that Moshe was called to Paro, and Paro said, pray. Take out the Tzvadim and I will send the people away. Now, it's a little difficult if you take it literally. Hirsch has some very good points, and even without him, you can see. The previous two times, which was the preliminary thing with the Taninim before the 10 plagues began, So it said that Aaron's Pharaoh's servants did the same tamimim, and therefore Pharaoh didn't care, although the Mata Aaron swallowed them in. Then it came to blood. Since they brought the blood about, again, Pharaoh didn't credit the same. Here it seems they also brought the Tzvah Deyim out. So why is he calling Moshe and Aaron and telling them to pray to God to take away the Tzvah Deyim? I mean, his people emulated the Tzvah Deyim. Well, you say the Tzvah Deyim caused them a lot of problems. So he wanted to get rid of the Tzvah Deyim. So if his people could bring the Tzvah Deyim, we would assume they could get rid of the Tzvah Deyim. So why does he call Aaron to say, and in sentence four, why does he call Moshe and Aaron get rid of the Tzvah Deyim? He should have first at least tried his people who brought the Tzvah Deyim in the previous sentence. This is something without Hirsch, that when you look at it, it troubles you. I mean, go in an orderly fashion. Your people have control over the Tzvah Deyim. Secondly, why would he tell his people to bring out Tzvah Deyim? There's enough coal in Newcastle. Someone would think that he would tell them to get rid of the Tzvah Deyim, not to bring Tzvah Deyim. If you're dealing about bottled blood and water, so you can test them the same way. But here, I mean, there were so many Tzvah Deyim around. What is the idea? Show that you're a master over something. Tell them to get rid of the Tzvah Deyim. Therefore, Hirsch learns that that's what he did. He told them to get rid of the Tzvah Deyim. No reason for him to bring more Tzvah Deyim. Like he questions, he says, one might think that when Aaron waved his hand, what they would do, they would make some hocus pocus so that it could appear that they had brought the frogs up, right? They would also do that, but if that was the case, why could they not do this also at the plague of the king? Shortly thereafter, in sentence 13 and 14, it says there by the vermin that in sentence 14, they could not do it. They couldn't do the keening. It was just like doing the same thing that he was doing. Secondly, he says, why would he want them to bring up the deen? Were there then perhaps too few frogs? Readily, it seems, in opposition to the way it is usually taken, he learns a different thing, that the efforts of the Tzvah Deyim of the Kinin was to do away with the Tzvah Deyim. That means Aaron went ahead in sentence 2, and the Tzvah Deyim came up. When they saw him waving the wand, so Vayasu came in sentence 3, they waved. Not Vayasu came, they brought out Tzvah Deyim. They did the same act that he did, and they tried to counter the Tzvah Deyim. But it says, the Yalu Esat Tzvah Deyim Al Eretz Mitzrayim. It didn't work. Their counter did not work. So not that they brought Tzvah Deyim. They sought to stop the Tzvah Deyim that Aaron brought about, but it didn't work.